This is the miraculous energy of the thunderbolts of Zeus, Yahweh, and the Supreme Buddha. The fertility of the reign of Viracocha. The virtue announced by the bell rung in the Mass at the consecration. And the light of the ultimate illumination of the saint and sage. Its guardians dare release it only to the duly proven. But the gods may be over-severe, over-cautious, in which case the hero must trick them of their treasure. Such was the problem of Prometheus. When in this mood even the highest gods appear as malignant, life-hoarding ogres, and the hero who deceives, slays, or appeases them is honored as the savior of the world. Maui of Polynesia went against Mahu Ika, the guardian of fire, to wring from him his treasure and transport it back to mankind. Maui, it must be told, was a great hero and a master of devices.
Maui went straight up to the giant Mahu Ika and said to him, "Clear away the brush from this level field of ours, so that we may contend together in friendly rivalry." Mahu Ika inquired, "What feat of mutual prowess and emulation shall it be?" "The feat of tossing," Maui replied. To this Mahu Ika agreed. Then Maui asked, "Who shall begin?" Mahu Ika answered, "I shall." Maui signified his consent, so Mahu Ika took hold of Maui and tossed him up in the air. He rose high above and fell right down into Mahu Ika's hands. Again Mahu Ika tossed Maui up, chanting, "Tossing, tossing, up you go." Up went Maui, and then Mahu Ika chanted this incantation. "Up you go to the first level. Up you go to the second level. Up you go to the third level. Up you go to the fourth level. Up you go to the fifth level. Up you go to the sixth level. Up you go to the seventh level. Up you go to the eighth level. Up you go to the ninth level. Up you go to the tenth level." Maui turned over and over in the air, and started to come down again, and he fell right beside Mahu Ika. Then Maui said, "You're having all the fun." "Why, indeed," Mahu Ika exclaimed. "Do you imagine you can send a whale flying up into the air?" "I can try," Maui answered. So Maui took hold of Mahu Ika and tossed him up, chanting, "Tossing, tossing, up you go." Up flew Mahu Ika, and now Maui chanted this spell. "Up you go to the first level. Up you go to the second level. Up you go to the third level. Up you go to the fourth level. Up you go to the fifth level. Up you go to the sixth level. Up you go to the seventh level. Up you go to the eighth level. Up you go to the ninth level. Up you go, way up in the air." Mahu Ika turned over and over in the air and commenced to fall back, and when he had nearly reached the ground, Maui called out these magic words, "That man up there, may he fall right on his head." Mahu Ika fell down. His neck was completely telescoped together, and so Mahu Ika died. At once the hero Maui took hold of the giant Mahu Ika's head and cut it off. Then he possessed himself of the treasure of the flame, which he bestowed upon the world.
The greatest tale of the elixir quest in the Mesopotamian pre-biblical tradition is that of Gilgamesh, a legendary king of the Sumerian city of Erech, who set forth to attain the watercress of immortality, the plant never grow old. After he had passed safely the lions that guard the foothills and the scorpion men who watch the heaven-supporting mountains, he came amidst the mountains to a paradise garden of flowers, fruits, and precious stones. Pressing on, he arrived at the sea that surrounds the world. In a cave beside the waters dwelt a manifestation of the goddess Ishtar, Siduri Sabitu. And this woman, closely veiled, closed the gates against him. But when he told her his tale, she admitted him to her presence and advised him not to pursue his quest, but to learn and be content with the mortal joys of life.
Gilgamesh, why dost thou run about this way? The life that thou art seeking, thou wilt never find. When the gods created man, they put death upon mankind, and held life in their own hands. Fill thy belly, Gilgamesh, day and night enjoy thyself. Prepare each day some pleasant occasion. Day and night be frolicsome and gay. Let thy clothes be handsome, thy head shampooed, thy body bathed. Regard the little one who takes thy hand. Let thy wife be happy against thy bosom. This passage, missing from the standard Assyrian edition of the legend, appears in a much earlier Babylonian fragmentary text. It has been frequently remarked that the advice of the Sibyl is hedonistic, but it should be noted also that the passage represents an initiatory test, not the moral philosophy of the ancient Babylonians. As in India centuries later, when a student approaches a teacher to ask the secret of immortal life, he is first put off with a description of the joys of the mortal. Only if he persists is he admitted to the next initiation.
But when Gilgamesh persisted, Siduri Sabitu gave him permission to pass and apprised him of the dangers of the way. The woman instructed him to seek the ferryman, Ursanapi, whom he found chopping wood in the forest and guarded by a group of attendants. Gilgamesh shattered these attendants. They were called those who rejoice to live, those of stone, and the ferryman consented to convey him across the waters of death. It was a voyage of 1.5 months. The passenger was warned not to touch the waters. Now, the far land that they were approaching was the residence of Utnapishtim, the hero of the primordial deluge, Babylonian prototype of the biblical Noah, here abiding with his wife in immortal peace. From afar, Utnapishtim spied the approaching little craft alone on the endless waters, and he wondered in his heart,
"Why are those of stone of the boat shattered, and someone who is not of my service sailing in the boat? That one who is coming, is he not a man?"
Gilgamesh, on landing, had to listen to the patriarch's long recitation of the story of the deluge. Then Utnapishtim bid his visitor sleep, and he slept for 6 days. Utnapishtim had his wife bake 7 loaves and place them by the head of Gilgamesh as he lay asleep beside the boat. And Utnapishtim touched Gilgamesh, and he awoke, and the host ordered the ferryman, Ursanapi, to give the guest a bath in a certain pool, and then fresh garments. Following that, Utnapishtim announced to Gilgamesh the secret of the plant.
"Gilgamesh, something secret I will disclose to thee, and give thee thine instruction. That plant is like a briar in the field. Its thorn, like that of the rose, will pierce thy hand. But if thy hand attain to that plant, thou wilt return to thy native land."
The plant was growing at the bottom of the cosmic sea. Ursanapi ferried the hero out again into the waters. Gilgamesh tied stones to his feet and plunged.
Though the hero was warned against touching these waters on the journey out, he now can enter them with impunity. This is a measure of the power gained through his visit with the old lord and lady of the everlasting island. Utnapishtim Noah, the flood hero, is an archetypal father figure. His island, the world navel, is a prefigurement of the later Greco-Roman Islands of the Blessed.
Down he rushed, beyond every bound of endurance, while the ferryman remained in the boat. And when the diver had reached the bottom of the bottomless sea, He plucked the plant, though it mutilated his hand, cut off the stones, and made again for the surface. When he broke the surface and the ferryman had hauled him back into the boat, he announced in triumph,
"Usanapi, this plant is the one by which man may attain to full vigor. I will bring it back to Erek of the sheep pens. Its name is, in his age, man becomes young again. I will eat of it and return to the condition of my youth."
They proceeded across the sea. When they had landed, Gilgamesh bathed in a cool water hole and lay down to rest. But while he slept, a serpent smelled the wonderful perfume of the plant, darted forth and carried it away. Eating it, the snake immediately gained the power of sloughing its skin, and so renewed its youth. But Gilgamesh, when he awoke, sat down and wept, and the tears ran down the wall of his nose. To this very day, the possibility of physical immortality charms the heart of man. The Utopian play by Bernard Shaw, Back to Methuselah, produced in 1921, converted the theme into a modern socio-biological parable. 400 years earlier, the more literal-minded Juan Ponce de Leon discovered Florida in a search for the land of Bimini, where he had expected to find the fountain of youth. While centuries before and far away, the Chinese philosopher Ko Hung spent the latter years of a long lifetime preparing pills of immortality. Ko Hung wrote,
"Take 3 pounds of genuine cinnabar and 1 pound of white honey. Mix them. Dry the mixture in the sun. Then roast it over a fire until it can be shaped into pills. Take 10 pills, the size of a hemp seed, every morning. Inside of a year, white hair will turn black. Decayed teeth will grow again, and the body will become sleek and glistening. If an old man takes this medicine for a long period of time, he will develop into a young man. The one who takes it constantly will enjoy eternal life and will not die."
A friend one day arrived to pay a visit to the solitary experimenter and philosopher, but all he found were Ko Hung's empty clothes. The old man was gone. He had passed into the realm of the immortals. The research for physical immortality proceeds from a misunderstanding of the traditional teaching. On the contrary, the basic problem is to enlarge the pupil of the eye so that the body, with its attendant personality, will no longer obstruct the view. Immortality is then experienced as a present fact. It is here. It is here.
All things are in process, rising and returning. Plants come to blossom, but only to return to the root. Returning to the root is like seeking tranquility. Seeking tranquility is like moving toward destiny. To move toward destiny is like eternity. To know eternity is enlightenment. And not to recognize eternity brings disorder and evil. Knowing eternity makes one comprehensive. Comprehension makes one broad-minded. Breadth of vision brings nobility. Nobility is like heaven. The heavenly is like Tao. Tao is the eternal. The decay of the body is not to be feared.
The Japanese have a proverb: the gods only laugh when men pray to them for wealth. The boon bestowed on the worshipper is always scaled to his stature and to the nature of his dominant desire. The boon is simply a symbol of life energy stepped down to the requirements of a certain specific case. The irony, of course, lies in the fact that whereas the hero who has won the favor of the god may beg for the boon of perfect illumination, what he generally seeks are longer years to live, weapons with which to slay his neighbor, or the health of his child. The Greeks tell of King Midas, who had the luck to win from Bacchus the offer of whatever boon he might desire. He asked that everything he touched should be turned to gold. When he went his way, he plucked experimentally the twig of an oak tree, and it was immediately gold. He took up a stone, it had turned to gold. An apple was a golden nugget in his hand. Ecstatic, he ordered prepared a magnificent feast to celebrate the miracle. But when he sat down and set his fingers to the roast, it was transmuted. At his lips the wine became liquid gold. And when his little daughter, whom he loved beyond anything on earth, came to console him in his misery, she became, the moment he embraced her, a pretty golden statue. The agony of breaking through personal limitations is the agony of spiritual growth. Art, literature, myth and cult, philosophy and ascetic disciplines are instruments to help the individual past his limiting horizons into spheres of ever-expanding realization. As he crosses threshold after threshold, conquering dragon after dragon, the stature of the divinity that he summons to his highest wish increases until it subsumes the cosmos. Finally, the mind breaks the bounding sphere of the cosmos to a realization transcending all experiences of form, all symbolizations, all divinities, a realization of the ineluctable void. So it is that when Dante had taken the last step in his spiritual adventure and came before the ultimate symbolic vision of the triune God in the celestial rose, he had still one more illumination to experience, even beyond the forms of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Bernard, he writes, made a sign to me and smiled, that I should look upward. But I was already of myself such as he wished, for my sight, becoming pure, was entering more and more through the radiance of the lofty light which in itself is true. Thenceforward my vision was greater than our speech, which yields to such a sight, and the memory yields to such excess. There goes neither the eye, nor speech, nor the mind. We know it not, nor do we see how to teach one about it. Different it is from all that are known, and it is beyond the unknown as well. This is the highest and ultimate crucifixion, not only of the hero, but of his God as well. Here the Son and the Father alike are annihilated, as personality masks over the unnamed. For just as the figments of a dream derive from the life energy of one dreamer, representing only fluid splitting and complications of that single force, so do all the forms of all the worlds, whether terrestrial or divine, reflect the universal force of a single inscrutable mystery, the power that constructs the atom and controls the orbits of the stars. That font of life is the core of the individual, and within himself he will find it, if he can tear the coverings away. The pagan Germanic divinity, Othon, Wotan, gave an eye to split the veil of light into the knowledge of this infinite dark, and then underwent for it the passion of a crucifixion.
I ween that I hung on the windy tree, hung there for night's full nine. With the spear I was wounded, and offered I was, to Othin, myself to myself, on the tree that none may ever know what root beneath it runs.
The Buddha's victory beneath the Bo tree is the classic Oriental example of this deed. With the sword of his mind he pierced the bubble of the universe, and it shattered into naught. The whole world of natural experience, as well as the continents, heavens, and hells of traditional religious belief, exploded, together with their gods and demons. But the miracle of miracles was that, though all exploded, all was nevertheless thereby renewed, revivified, and made glorious with the effulgence of true being. Indeed, the gods of the redeemed heavens raised their voices in harmonious acclaim of the man-hero, who had penetrated beyond them to the void that was their life and source.
Flags and banners erected on the eastern rim of the world let their streamers fly to the western rim of the world. Likewise, those erected on the western rim of the world to the eastern rim of the world. Those erected on the northern rim of the world to the southern rim of the world. And those erected on the southern rim of the world to the northern rim of the world. While those erected on the level of the earth let theirs fly until they beat against the Brahma world. And those of the Brahma world let theirs hang down to the level of the earth. Throughout the 10,000 worlds the flowering trees bloomed. The fruit trees were weighted down by the burden of their fruit. Trunk lotuses bloomed on the trunks of trees. Branch lotuses on the branches of trees. Vine lotuses on the vines. Hanging lotuses in the sky. And stalk lotuses burst through the rocks and came up by sevens. The system of 10,000 worlds was like a bouquet of flowers sent whirling through the air, or like a thick carpet of flowers. In the intermundane spaces, the 8,000-league-long hells, which not even the light of seven suns had formerly been able to illumine, were now flooded with radiance. The 84,000-league-deep ocean became sweet to the taste. The rivers checked their flowing. The blind from birth received their sight, the deaf from birth their hearing, the crippled from birth the use of their limbs, and the bonds and fetters of captives broke and fell off.
Chapter 3. Return. 1. Refusal of the return. When the hero quest has been accomplished, through penetration to the source, or through the grace of some male or female, human or animal personification, the adventurer still must return with his life-transmuting trophy. The full round, the norm of the monomyth, requires that the hero shall now begin the labor of bringing the runes of wisdom, the golden fleece, or his sleeping princess, back into the kingdom of humanity, where the boon may redound to the renewing of the community, the nation, the planet, or the 10,000 worlds. But the responsibility has been frequently refused. Even the Buddha, after his triumph, doubted whether the message of realization could be communicated, and saints are reported to have passed away while in the supernal ecstasy. Numerous indeed are the heroes fabled to have taken up residence forever in the Blessed Isle of the unaging goddess of immortal being. A moving tale is told of an ancient Hindu warrior king named Muchukunda. He was born from his father's left side, the father having swallowed, by mistake, a fertility potion that the Brahmins had prepared for his wife. And in keeping with the promising symbolism of this miracle, the motherless marvel, fruit of the male womb, grew to be such a king among kings that when the gods, at one period, were suffering defeat in their perpetual contest with the demons, they called upon him for help. He assisted them to a mighty victory, and they, in their divine pleasure, granted him the realization of his highest wish. But what should such a king, himself almost omnipotent, desire? What greatest boon of boons could be conceived of by such a master among men? King Muchukunda, so runs the story, was very tired after his battle. All he asked was that he might be granted sleep without end, and that any person chancing to arouse him should be burned to a crisp by the first glance of his eye. The boon was bestowed. In a cavern chamber, deep within the womb of the mountain, King Muchukunda retired to sleep, and there slumbered through the revolving eons. Individuals, peoples, civilizations, world ages came into being out of the void and dropped back into it again, while the old king, in his state of subconscious bliss, endured. Timeless as the Freudian unconscious beneath the dramatic time world of our fluctuating ego experience, the old mountain man, the drinker of deep sleep, lived on and on. His awakening came, but with a surprising turn that throws into new perspective the whole problem of the hero circuit, as well as the mystery of the mighty king's request for sleep as the highest conceivable boon. Vishnu, the lord of the world, had become incarnate in the person of a beautiful youth named Krishna, who, having saved the land of India from a tyrannical race of demons, had assumed the throne. And he had been ruling in utopian peace when a horde of barbarians suddenly invaded from the northwest. Krishna, the king, went against them, but in keeping with his divine nature, won the victory playfully, by simple ruse. Unarmed and garlanded with lotuses, he came out of his stronghold and tempted the enemy king to pursue and catch him, then dodged into a cave. When the barbarian followed, he discovered someone lying there in the chamber, asleep. "Oh," thought he, "so he has lured me here, and now he feigns to be a harmless sleeper." He kicked the figure lying on the ground before him, and it stirred. It was King Muchukunda. The figure rose, and the eyes that had been closed for unnumbered cycles of creation, world history, and dissolution opened slowly to the light. The first glance that went forth struck the enemy king, who burst into a torch of flame and was reduced immediately to a smoking heap of ash. Muchukunda turned, and the second glance struck the garlanded, beautiful youth, whom the awakened old king straightway recognized by his radiance as an incarnation of God. And Muchukunda bowed before his Savior with the following prayer.
"My Lord God, when I lived and wrought as a man, I lived and wrought, straying restlessly. Through many lives, birth after birth, I sought and suffered, nowhere knowing cease or rest. Distress I took for joy. Mirages appearing over the desert I mistook for refreshing waters. Delights I grasped, and what I obtained was misery. Kingly power and earthly possession, riches and might, friends and sons, wife and followers, everything that lures the senses. I wanted them all, because I believed that these would bring me beatitude. But the moment anything was mine, it changed its nature and became as a burning fire. Then I found my way into the company of the gods, and they welcomed me as a companion. But where, still, surcease? Where, rest? The creatures of this world, gods included, are all tricked, my Lord God, by your playful ruses. That is why they continue in their futile round of birth, life agony, old age, and death. Between lives, they confront the Lord of the dead, and are forced to endure hells of every degree of pitiless pain. And it all comes from you. My Lord God, deluded by your playful ruses, I too was a prey of the world, wandering in a labyrinth of error, netted in the meshes of ego consciousness. Now, therefore, I take refuge in your presence, the boundless, the adorable, desiring only freedom from it all."
When Muchukunda stepped from his cave, he saw that men, since his departure, had become reduced in stature. He was as a giant among them. And so he departed from them again, retreated to the highest mountains, and there dedicated himself to the ascetic practices that should finally release him from his last attachment to the forms of being. Muchukunda, in other words, instead of returning, decided to retreat one degree still further from the world. And who shall say that his decision was altogether without reason? 2. The Magic Flight. If the hero in his triumph wins the blessing of the goddess or the god, and is then explicitly commissioned to return to the world with some elixir for the restoration of society, the final stage of his adventure is supported by all the powers of his supernatural patron. On the other hand, if the trophy has been attained against the opposition of its guardian, or if the hero's wish to return to the world has been resented by the gods or demons, then the last stage of the mythological round becomes a lively, often comical, pursuit. This flight may be complicated by marvels of magical obstruction and evasion. The Welsh tale, for instance, of a hero, Gwion Bach, who found himself in the land under waves. Specifically, he was at the bottom of Lake Bala, in Merionethshire, in the north of Wales. And there lived at the bottom of this lake an ancient giant, Tegid the Bald, together with his wife, Caridwen. The latter, in one of her aspects, was a patroness of grain and fertile crops, and in another, a goddess of poetry and letters. She was the owner of an immense kettle, and desired to prepare therein a brew of science and inspiration. With the aid of necromantic books, she contrived a black concoction, which she then set over a fire to brew for a year, at the end of which period 3 blessed drops should be obtained of the grace of inspiration. And she put our hero, Gwion Bach, to stir the cauldron, and a blind man named Morda to keep the fire kindled beneath it, and she charged them that they should not suffer it to cease boiling for the space of a year and a day. And she herself, according to the books of the astronomers and in planetary hours, gathered every day of all charm-bearing herbs. And one day, towards the end of the year, as Caridwen was culling plants and making incantations, it chanced that 3 drops of the charmed liquor flew out of the cauldron and fell upon the finger of Gwion Bach. And by reason of their great heat, he put his finger in his mouth, and the instant he put those marvel-working drops into his mouth, he foresaw everything that was to come, and perceived that his chief care must be to guard against the wiles of Caridwen, for vast was her skill. And in very great fear, he fled towards his own land. And the cauldron burst in two, because all the liquor within it, except the 3 charm-bearing drops, was poisonous, so that the horses of Gwythno Garanhir were poisoned by the water of the stream into which the liquor of the cauldron ran. And the confluence of that stream was called the Poison of the Horses of Gwythno, from that time forth.
Thereupon came in Caridwen, and saw all the toil of the whole year lost. And she seized a billet of wood, and struck the blind Morda on the head, until one of his eyes fell out upon his cheek. And he said, "Wrongfully hast thou disfigured me, for I am innocent. Thy loss was not because of me." "Thou speakest truth," said Caridwen. "It was Gwion Bach who robbed me." And she went forth after him, running. And he saw her, and changed himself into a hare, and fled. But she changed herself into a greyhound, and turned him. And he ran towards a river, and became a fish. And she, in the form of an otter bitch, chased him under the water until he was fain to turn himself into a bird of the air. She, as a hawk, followed him and gave him no rest in the sky. And just as she was about to stoop upon him and he was in fear of death, he espied a heap of winnowed wheat on the floor of a barn, and he dropped among the wheat and turned himself into one of the grains. Then she transformed herself into a high-crested black hen, and went to the wheat, and scratched it with her feet, and found him out, and swallowed him. And, as the story says, she bore him 9 months, and when she was delivered of him, She could not find it in her heart to kill him by reason of his beauty. So she wrapped him in a leathern bag and cast him into the sea to the mercy of God on the 29th day of April.
The tale of Gwyanbach comes to us through Taliesin in the Mabinogion, a collection of Welsh romances translated by Lady Charlotte Guest in four volumes between 1838 and 1849. Taliesin, chief of the Bards of the West, may have been an actual historical personage of the 6th century AD, contemporary with the chieftain who became the King Arthur of later romance. The bard's legend and poems survive in a 13th century manuscript, the Book of Taliesin, which is one of the four ancient books of Wales. A Mabinog, Welsh, is a bard's apprentice. The term Mabinogi, juvenile instruction, denotes the traditional material, myths, legends, poems, etc., taught to a Mabinog, and which it was his duty to acquire by heart. Mabinogion, the plural of Mabinogi, was the name given by Guest to her translation of 11 romances from the ancient books. The bardic lore of Wales, like that of Scotland and Ireland, descends from a very old and abundant pagan Celtic fund of myth. This was transformed and revivified by the Christian missionaries and chroniclers, 5th century and following, who recorded the old stories and sought painstakingly to coordinate them with the Bible. During the 10th century, a brilliant period of romance production, centering primarily in Ireland, converted the inheritance into an important contemporary force. Celtic bards went out to the courts of Christian Europe. Celtic themes were rehearsed by the pagan Scandinavian skalds. A great part of our European fairy lore, as well as the foundation of the Arthurian tradition, traces back to this first great creative period of Occidental romance.
The flight is a favorite episode of the folk tale, where it is developed under many lively forms. The Buryat of Irkutsk, Siberia, for example, declare that Morgon Kara, their first shaman, was so competent that he could bring back souls from the dead. And so the Lord of the Dead complained to the High God of Heaven, and God decided to pose the shaman a test. He got possession of the soul of a certain man and slipped it into a bottle, covering the opening with the ball of his thumb. The man grew ill, and his relatives sent for Morgon Kara. The shaman looked everywhere for the missing soul. He searched the forest, the waters, the mountain gorges, the land of the dead, and at last mounted, sitting on his drum, to the world above, where again he was forced to search for a long time. Presently he observed that the High God of Heaven was keeping a bottle covered with the ball of his thumb, and, studying the circumstance, perceived that inside the bottle was the very soul he had come to find. The wily shaman changed himself into a wasp. He flew at God and gave him such a hot sting on the forehead that the thumb jerked from the opening and the captive got away. Then the next thing God knew, there was this shaman, Morgon Kara, sitting on his drum again and going down to earth with the recovered soul. The flight in this case, however, was not entirely successful. Becoming terribly angry, God immediately diminished the power of the shaman forever by splitting his drum in two. And so that is why shaman drums, which originally, according to this story of the Buryat, were fitted with two heads of skin, from that day to this, have had only one. A popular variety of the magic flight is that in which objects are left behind to speak for the fugitive and thus delay pursuit. The New Zealand Maori tell of a fisherman who one day came home to find that his wife had swallowed their two sons. She was lying groaning on the floor. He asked her what the trouble was, and she declared that she was ill. He demanded to know where the two boys were, and she told him they had gone away. But he knew that she was lying. With his magic, he caused her to disgorge them. They came out alive and whole. Then that man was afraid of his wife, and he determined to escape from her as soon as he could, together with the boys. When the ogress went to fetch water, the man, by his magic, caused the water to decrease and retreat ahead of her, so that she had to go a considerable way. Then, by gestures, he instructed the huts, the clumps of trees growing near the village, the filth dump, and the temple on top of the hill, to answer for him when his wife should return and call. He made away with the boys to his canoe, and they hoisted sail. The woman came back and, not finding anyone about, began to call. First the filth pit replied. She moved in that direction and called again. The houses answered, then the trees. One after another, the various objects in the neighborhood responded to her, and she ran, increasingly bewildered, in every direction. She became weak and began to pant and sob, and then, at last, realized what had been done to her. She hastened to the temple on the hilltop and peered out to sea, where the canoe was a mere speck on the horizon. Another well-known variety of the magic flight is one in which a number of delaying obstacles are tossed behind by the wildly fleeing hero.
A little brother and sister were playing by a spring, and as they did so, suddenly tumbled in. There was a water hag down there, and this water hag said, "Now I have you. Now you shall work your heads off for me." And she carried them away with her. She gave to the little girl a tangle of filthy flax to spin and made her fetch water in a bottomless tub. The boy had to chop a tree with a blunt axe, and all they ever had to eat were stone-hard lumps of dough. So at last the children became so impatient that they waited until one Sunday when the hag had gone to church and escaped. When church let out, the hag discovered that her birds had flown, and so made after them with mighty bounds. But the children espied her from afar, and the little girl threw back a hairbrush, which immediately turned into a big brush mountain with thousands and thousands of bristles over which the hag found it very difficult to climb. Nevertheless, she finally appeared. As soon as the children saw her, the boy threw back a comb, which immediately turned into a big comb mountain with 1,000 times 1,000 spikes. But the hag knew how to catch hold of these, and at last she made her way through. Then the little girl threw back a mirror, and this turned into a mirror mountain, which was so smooth that the hag was unable to get over. Thought she, "I shall hurry back home and get my axe and chop the mirror mountain in two." But by the time she got back and demolished the glass, the children were long since far away, and the water hag had to trudge back again to her spring.
The powers of the abyss are not to be challenged lightly. In the Orient, a great point is made of the danger of undertaking the psychologically disturbing practices of yoga without competent supervision. The meditations of the postulant have to be adjusted to his progress, so that the imagination may be defended at every step by devatas, envisioned adequate deities, until the moment comes for the prepared spirit to step alone beyond. As Dr. Jung has very wisely observed,
"The incomparably useful function of the dogmatic symbol is that it protects a person from a direct experience of God, as long as he does not mischievously expose himself. But if he leaves home and family, lives too long alone, and gazes too deeply into the dark mirror, then the awful event of the meeting may befall him. Yet even then, the traditional symbol, come to full flower through the centuries, may operate like a healing draught and divert the fatal incursion of the living Godhead into the hallowed spaces of the church."
The magic objects tossed behind by the panic-ridden hero, protective interpretations, principles, symbols, rationalizations, anything, delay and absorb the power of the started Hound of Heaven, permitting the adventurer to come back into his fold safe and with perhaps a boon. But the toll required is not always slight. One of the most shocking of the obstacle flights is that of the Greek hero Jason. He had set forth to win the Golden Fleece, putting to sea in the magnificent Argo with a great company of warriors. He had sailed in the direction of the Black Sea, and though delayed by many fabulous dangers, arrived at last, miles beyond the Bosporus, at the city and palace of King Aeetes. Behind the palace was the grove and tree of the dragon-guarded prize. Now the daughter of the king, Medea, conceived an overpowering passion for the illustrious foreign visitor, and when her father imposed an impossible task as the price of the Golden Fleece, compounded charms that enabled him to succeed. The task was to plow a certain field, employing bulls of flaming breath and brazen feet, then to sow the field with dragons' teeth, and slay the armed men who should immediately spring into being. But with his body and armor anointed with Medea's charm, Jason mastered the bulls, and when the army sprang from the dragon seed, he tossed a stone into their midst, which turned them face to face, and they slew each other to the man. The infatuated young woman conducted Jason to the yoke from which hung the fleece. The guarding dragon was distinguished by a crest, a three-forked tongue, and nastily hooked fangs. But with the juice of a certain herb, the couple put the formidable monster to sleep. Then Jason snatched the prize. Medea ran with him, and the Argo put to sea. But the king was soon in swift pursuit, and when Medea perceived that his sails were cutting down their lead, she persuaded Jason to kill Apsyrtos, her younger brother, whom she had carried off, and toss the pieces of the dismembered body into the sea. This forced King Aeetes, her father, to put about, rescue the fragments, and go ashore to give them decent burial. Meanwhile the Argo ran with the wind and passed from his ken. In the Japanese Records of Ancient Matters appears another harrowing tale, but a very different import. That of the descent to the underworld of the primeval All-Father, Izanagi, to recover from the land of the Yellow Stream his deceased sister-spouse, Izanami. She met him at the door to the lower world, and he said to her, "Thine Augustness, my lovely younger sister, the lands that I and thou made are not yet finished making, so come back." She replied, "Lamentable indeed that thou camest not sooner. I have eaten of the food of the land of the Yellow Stream. Nevertheless, as I am overpowered by the honor of the entry here of thine Augustness, my lovely elder brother, I wish to return. Moreover, I will discuss the matter particularly with the deities of the Yellow Stream. Be careful. Do not look at me." She retired into the palace, but as she tarried there very long, he could not wait. He broke off one of the end teeth of the comb that was stuck in the august left bunch of his hair, and, lighting it as a little torch, he went in and looked. What he saw were maggots swarming, and Izanami rotting. Aghast at the sight, Izanagi fled back. Izanami said, "Thou hast put me to shame." Izanami sent the ugly female of the netherworld in pursuit. Izanagi, in full flight, took the black headdress from his head and cast it down. Instantly, it turned into grapes, and, while his pursuer paused to eat them, he continued on his rapid way. But she resumed the pursuit and gained on him. He took and broke the multitudinous and close-toothed comb in the bright bunch of his hair, and cast it down. Instantly, it turned into bamboo sprouts, and, while she pulled them up and ate them, he fled. Then his younger sister sent in pursuit of him the 8 thunder deities with 1,500 warriors of the Yellow Stream. Drawing the 10-grasp saber that was augustly girded on him, he fled, brandishing this behind him. But the warriors still pursued. Reaching the frontier pass between the world of the living and the land of the Yellow Stream, he took 3 peaches that were growing there, waited, and when the army came against him, hurled them. The peaches from the world of the living smote the warriors of the land of the Yellow Stream, who turned and fled. Her augustness, Izanami, last of all, came out herself. So he drew up a rock which it would take 1,000 men to lift, and with it blocked up the pass. And with the rock between them, they stood opposite to one another, and exchanged leave-takings. Izanami said, "My lovely elder brother, thine augustness, if thou dost behave like this, henceforth I shall cause to die every day 1,000 of thy people in thy realm." Izanagi answered, "My lovely younger sister, thine augustness, if thou dost so, then I will cause every day 1,500 women to give birth." Having moved a step beyond the creative sphere of All-Father Izanagi into the field of dissolution, Izanami had sought to protect her brother husband. When he had seen more than he could bear, he lost his innocence of death, but, with his august will to live, drew up as a mighty rock that protecting veil which we all have held, ever since, between our eyes and the grave. The Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, and hundreds of analogous tales throughout the world, suggest, as does this ancient legend of the farthest east, that in spite of the failure recorded, a possibility exists of a return of the lover with his lost love from beyond the terrible threshold. It is always some little fault, some slight yet critical symptom of human frailty that makes impossible the open interrelationship between the worlds, so that one is tempted to believe, almost, that if the small, marring accident could be avoided, all would be well. In the Polynesian versions of the romance, however, where the fleeing couple usually escape, and in the Greek satyr play of Alcestis, where we also have a happy return, the effect is not reassuring, but only superhuman. The myths of failure touch us with the tragedy of life, but those of success only with their own incredibility. And yet, if the monomyth is to fulfill its promise, not human failure or superhuman success, but human success, is what we shall have to be shown. That is the problem of the crisis of the threshold of the return. We shall first consider it in the superhuman symbols, and then seek the practical teaching for historic man. 3. Rescue from without. The hero may have to be brought back from his supernatural adventure by assistance from without. That is to say, the world may have to come and get him. For the bliss of the deep abode is not lightly abandoned in favor of the self-scattering of the wakened state. "Who, having cast off the world," we read, "would desire to return again? He would be only there." And yet, insofar as one is alive, life will call. Society is jealous of those who remain away from it, and will come knocking at the door. If the hero, like Muchukunda, is unwilling, the disturber suffers an ugly shock. But on the other hand, if the summoned one is only delayed, sealed in by the beatitude of the state of perfect being, which resembles death, an apparent rescue is effected, and the adventurer returns. When Raven of the Eskimo tale had darted with his fire sticks into the belly of the whale cow, he discovered himself at the entrance of a handsome room, at the farther end of which burned a lamp. He was surprised to see sitting there a beautiful girl. The room was dry and clean, the whale's spine supporting the ceiling, and the ribs forming the walls. From a tube that ran along the backbone, oil dripped slowly into the lamp. When Raven entered the room, the woman looked up and cried, "How did you get here? You are the first man to enter this place." Raven told what he had done, and she bade him take a seat on the opposite side of the room. This woman was the soul, Inua, of the whale. She spread a meal before the visitor, gave him berries and oil, and told him, meanwhile, how she had gathered the berries the year before. Raven remained 4 days as guest of the Inua in the belly of the whale, and during the entire period was trying to ascertain what kind of tube that could be, running along the ceiling. Every time the woman left the room, she forbade him to touch it. But now, when she again went out, he walked over to the lamp, stretched out his claw, and caught on it a big drop, which he licked off with his tongue. It was so sweet that he repeated the act, and then proceeded to catch drop after drop as fast as they fell. Presently, however, his greed found this too slow, and so he reached up, broke off a piece of the tube, and ate it. Hardly had he done so when a great gush of oil poured into the room, extinguished the light, and the chamber itself began to roll heavily back and forth. This rolling went on for 4 days. Raven was almost dead with fatigue and with the terrible noise that stormed around him all the while. But then, everything quieted down, and the room lay still. For Raven had broken one of the heart arteries, and the whale cow had died. The Inua never returned. The body of the whale was washed ashore. But now, Raven was a prisoner. While he pondered what he should do, he heard two men talking, up on the back of the animal, and they decided to summon all the people from the village to help with the whale. Very soon they had cut a hole in the upper part of the great body. When it was large enough, and all the people had gone off with pieces of meat to carry them high up on the shore, Raven stepped out, unnoticed. In many myths of the hero in the whale's belly, he is rescued by birds that peck open the side of his prison. But no sooner had he reached the ground than he remembered he had left his fire sticks within. He took off his coat and mask, and pretty soon the people saw a small black man, wrapped up in a queer animal skin, approaching them. They looked at him curiously. The man offered to help, rolled up his sleeves, and set to work. In a little while, one of the people working in the interior of the whale shouted, "Look what I have found! Fire sticks in the belly of the whale!" Raven said, "My, but this is bad. My daughter once told me that when fire sticks are found inside a whale that people have cut open, many of these people will die. I'm for running." He rolled down his sleeves again and made away. The people hurried to follow his example. And so that was how Raven, who then doubled back, had, for a time, the whole feast to himself. One of the most important and delightful of the myths of the Shinto tradition of Japan, already old when chronicled in the 8th century A.D., in The Records of Ancient Matters, is that of the drawing forth of the beautiful sun goddess Amaterasu from a heavenly rock dwelling during the critical first period of the world.
Shinto, the way of the gods, the tradition native to the Japanese as distinguished from the imported Butsudo, or way of the Buddha, is a way of devotion to the guardians of life and custom, local spirits, ancestral powers, heroes, the divine king, one's living parents and one's living children, as distinguished from the powers that yield release from the round, bodhisattvas and buddhas. The way of worship is primarily that of preserving and cultivating purity of heart. What is ablution? It is not merely cleansing the body with holy water, but following the right and moral way. What pleases the deity is virtue and sincerity, not any number of material offerings. Amaterasu, ancestress of the royal house, is the chief divinity of the numerous